From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters. Life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with philosopher Jay Richards, co-author of the 20th anniversary updated and revised edition of The Privileged Planet, How Our Place in the Cosmos is Designed for Discovery. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Jay Richards in their conversation.
I honestly think in some ways, God left it to this time for the created order to disclose these things about it. The psalmist, from the beginning, of course, the psalmist, as you said, he said, the heavens declare the glory of God. So it's actively participating in the glory of God, but there's rich detail and more detail all the way down. It's like wheels within wheels or an encrypted message in which there's one message at one level and then you magnify it and you find another message. That's what I think is happening. And I think, look, if we're right, Guillermo and I, we found the first couple of dozen good examples of this, but we think if we're right, we'll discover a bunch of other stuff and the pattern will continue to be confirmed.
You use so many memorable phrases. One of the phrases that you use in your talks and in your writing is the fact that Earth is a data recorder.
Yes. And this is another thing that's our chapter two. And so we all know that you can count the age of a tree by reading tree rings as a kind of rough estimate, right? And so it's just a kind of an accretion of development with the tree rings or by, you know, cutting at the trunk of a tree. A few people know that they're ice cores. So for instance, there's Lake Vostok in Antarctica and sites in Greenland in which you can kind of do the same thing vertically. You can just drill a core and there are these layers of ice that get more and more compressed. And based upon the isotope ratios that correspond to the sunspot cycles, you can actually date those in these kind of 11-year increments. And then based upon the materials that are in those layers and isotope ratios, you can actually figure out what's happening in the distant past in terms of temperature, what's happening in terms of the climate, all sorts of things that you can reconstruct it much sort of farther back than you could with tree rings. There are cores on lake sediments and ocean sediments. There, you can do the same thing with stalactites and stalagmites. These are these layering processes that only exist. First of all, they're all either based upon the hydrological cycle or basic biological processes needed for life. And yet they're also laying down a recording of all sorts of things that have happened in the past so that we have a much better understanding of what's happened. We kind of know that in terms of archaeology, and people might say, okay, well, that's neat. We know maybe a few hundred years with trees, but you can get information a lot farther back. And so now remember, our argument is that, okay, habitable planets are going to be better at these things than non-habitable planets. Well, guess what? If you compare our planet and those layering processes to other planets, they have nothing like this. They're just not really good data recording systems like that on planets that are hostile to life. So it's just yet another example. And so we think, look, when you walk around and you look at trees, be astounded, but also realize they're data recorders. They're rolled up scrolls recording data about what we're doing and what other people are doing and what the atmosphere is like at this moment.
Let's get into something really controversial, climate change.
Oh, yeah.
How does the privileged planet hypothesis inform the current climate change debate? I mean, we're talking, Jay, about politicians being convinced that we need to spend tens, maybe hundreds of trillions of dollars on climate change, that it's an existential problem, that's the greatest problem. I mean, kids are afraid, the fear-mongering is intense. But the privileged planet hypothesis actually helps inform us here.
It does. And so just for people that only follow this superficially, the sort of climate change catastrophist claim is that our contributions of CO2 in particular into the atmosphere, CO2 is this three-atom molecule, and so it's a greenhouse gas, is causing the surface of the planet to heat up more, far more than it would naturally, and that's going to lead to catastrophic types of climate that's, as you said, going to be catastrophic to humans and to life. First thing to note is that there's no justification for those extreme claims. And so if you even read the overheated Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports from the UN, none of those never justify this. They'll say, okay, yeah, we think based upon our computer models that we'll get between 1 and 5 degrees centigrade warming in the next 100 years. There's really not even a justification for that. But notice that in either of those cases, it's not catastrophic. I mean, anyone living at upper latitudes experiences a heck of a lot more than 5 degrees change in temperature every day. And so the idea that, you know, this would somehow lead to the extinction of life is just nonsense. But then the second question would be, okay, how sensitive is the climate to additions of CO2? And the great thing here is that we actually have data. As I mentioned, those recording devices, we have data about what's happened in the distant past. There are times in the distant past when the atmosphere had vastly, vastly more carbon dioxide. I mean, order of magnitude more carbon dioxide than it does now. There was no runaway greenhouse effect. It didn't wipe out life. In fact, plant life really likes carbon dioxide. It's plant food. Ironically, if you get too low concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere, below 150 parts per million, plant life ceases. So that's the catastrophe. And so the fact that our planet actually records information allows us to test these predictive computer models. The computer models, remember, are just programs on computers in which you plug in variables based on your assumptions and see what would happen if your assumptions are true. They have to be tested against reality. But we already know the climate is not nearly as sensitive to carbon dioxide as these models predict. And we know that precisely because the Earth has been recording this information. Now, here's the ironic thing, is that if you think about what's really kind of worrisome in distant past climate, it's not warm patches, it's ice ages. When a huge amount of the Earth is covered in, you know, a couple of miles of ice. That's the thing we ought to worry about. And we're actually kind of due for another ice age. It may be that our contribution of CO2 through industrial processes, while not making all that much difference in terms of warming, may help helping stave off another ice age. That's still kind of an open question, but we think there's actually some evidence of that. And so this is obviously sort of directly related to this. And I can tell you, Hank, I mean, Guillermo and I started following all this debate in 1999 when we started on the book. The arguments have gotten worse and worse and worse on the other side for catastrophe. And so it makes me really sad that people don't know enough about the evidence that they just sort of they believe these hysterical claims.
So you have someone, and not to pick on any particular politician, but Joe Biden, he's kind of an easy target.
Yeah.
But you hear him talk about this dogmatically. Do you think, I mean, this is a speculative question, do you think he really understands climate change in any comprehensive sense?
No, I don't think so. In fact, the only... there was a politician, Inhofe, Senator Inhofe from Oklahoma, that really followed the science. Al Gore, though he was wrong about a lot of stuff, at least was kind of interested in the science. Now, he infamously misinterpreted data from past climate, in which he claimed that wherever you get an increase in CO2, you get an increase in temperature. And so he was assuming that was a sort of causal relationship, but he had messed up the sequence, because what actually happens is that you get the temperature increase about 800 years before the CO2 increase. And so he'd actually sort of reversed cause and effect. And the reason for that is that when it's cool, the ocean can hold more CO2, and when it's warm, it releases it. So even the New York Times had to correct Al Gore on that in his documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. But he followed it. But most politicians that I've seen don't have any obvious understanding of this at all. I assume most of them are sincere, but they're just listening to their sort of selected experts. But notice that if you're a politician that wants to increase your power, especially your power over people's choices and over the economy, Climate change hysteria gives you a justification for that because you say, well, yeah, all things being equal, people should be free to make choices about transportation and fuel use, but there's this existential threat. And so for the common good, we're going to have to tell you exactly what you want to do. That's the net zero campaign, this idea that we're going to, by 2050 or even 2030, contribute no net carbon emissions, no more CO2 to the atmosphere. Well, this is completely insane. This is never going to happen. China and India are still developing. They're not going to quit doing it. And so that's why I think we should just look askance at politicians talking about this, because it's a justification for them to increase their power over us, even if they're sincere. I think that's basically what this is about. And very few of them, so far as I can tell, have actually spent any time studying the details.
Yeah, so for all of us, many years ago, I learned from you a particular sequence that'll help all of us. You taught us really how to ask the right questions and then how to ask the right questions in the right sequence. So when you're confronted with something like climate change, you actually know what to do.
Stay right there. We'll be back soon to rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Dr. Jay Richards. In the 20th anniversary revised and updated edition of The Privileged Planet, How Our Place in the Cosmos is Designed for Discovery, astronomer Guillermo Gonzalez and philosopher Jay Richards lay out remarkable evidence showing that our Earth is a privileged planet designed for discovery. To receive the 20th anniversary revised and updated edition of The Privileged Planet, How Our Place in the Cosmos is Designed for Discovery, for your gift to the ongoing work of the Christian Research Institute, call 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI. Or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. The number of wolves surrounding the Christian flock is growing, and they relish nothing more than docile sheep utterly incapable of defending themselves. From militant secularists at home to militant Islamists abroad, the assaults on biblical Christianity are growing dangerously. But Christian Research Institute support team members aren't in favor of feeding these wolves. Instead, each day they're making possible an array of outreaches that defang these wolf packs with solid arguments and evidence that have stood the test of time. What's more, support team members are equipping themselves with CRI's Equipping Essentials, a hand-picked collection of the best apologetics tools around. Your selection of resources are just our way of saying thanks. To learn more about the benefits of membership, simply visit equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. The Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition is the comprehensive collection of the most often asked questions Hank Hanegraaff has received throughout his four decades as host of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. With more than 500,000 copies already in print, this newly revised and expanded Collector's Edition helps seekers and skeptics alike sort through the truth on topics such as reliability of the Bible, religions and cults, the resurrection and afterlife, and many more issues vital to a better understanding of God in Christ and our relationship to Him. To receive your copy of the Complete Bible Answer Book, Collector's Edition, Revised and Expanded, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or visit us at equip.org. Has God spoken? Are the words of Scripture merely human in origin, or are they in fact the very words of God Himself? 3 years in the making and based on two decades of research and reflection, Hank Hanegraaff's monumental book, Has God Spoken?, answers what is surely the most important question facing our world. In Has God Spoken? Memorable Proofs of the Bible's Divine Inspiration, Hank counters the contentions of the Bible attackers and clearly shows that belief in the Holy Scriptures is not a guess or wishful thinking. It is the only logical conclusion after an honest examination of overwhelming evidence. Order Has God Spoken from the Christian Research Institute by calling 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org, equip.org. Here again are Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, philosopher Jay Richards, as they continue their conversation.
You taught us really how to ask the right questions and then how to ask the right questions in the right sequence. So when you're confronted with something like climate change, you actually know what to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so this is the four questions, which is probably maybe the thing that I've developed that went the farthest was just these four questions. So somebody says, do you believe in global warming or climate change? That's actually a bundle of different claims, you know, sort of put together. So the question you want to ask is, okay, first, is the Earth warming? That's just that straightforward empirical question. Is there a warming trend if you take some baseline, say 1850 to the present? That's just what's happening, right? So let's go look at the evidence. The second question is, are we causing it? That is human activity the main or primary cause of it? So that's a separate question, right? Something's happening. What's causing it is a different question. You know, the ice caps could be melting, polar bears could be drowning. That doesn't tell you whether humans are doing anything to it. The third question is it bad? That is, let's assume that the Earth's warming. Let's assume humans are causing it. Is it bad? That is the warming bad and is the contribution of CO2 to the atmosphere bad? The only way you could say that warming is bad is if you knew what the optimum global temperature was. That is, what's the optimum average global temperature? If we knew what that was, and you'd say, okay, well, are we moving toward it or away from it? Climate alarmists assume that we're moving away from it, that somehow it's cooler than it is now. But there's actually no evidence that that's the case. It could be very well that the optimum temperature, say, for human life or plant life, is a little warmer than it is now. So that's at least a debatable question. And then the fourth question is, let's assume the answer to the first three is yes, that the Earth's warming, we're causing it, it's bad. Would any of the advised policies make any difference? And that's an economic question. It's actually really easy. The Kyoto Protocol, initially in the 90s, we knew would cost trillions of dollars and make no difference. The Paris Accords, which countries generally did not abide by, would cost a lot and make no difference. Net zero would cost, net zero would just basically move us back to hunter-gatherer stage or something like that, probably. So the cost would be immense and it still wouldn't probably make a difference. And then I've since added a fifth question, what should we do instead? So in other words, the policies that are being advised are crazy. What should we do instead? Well, we know that the wealthier a country is, the more technologically advanced, the more they're able to adapt to things. So if whatever happens, right, if we have an ice age, if we have increased warming, the wealthier a country is, the easier it's going to be for them to adapt to it. So what we should do is pursue policies, global policies and trade policies that help poor countries become wealthier so that they can adapt to it just as well as we can. And the bonus is that as countries get wealthier, they get more concerned about environmental issues. And so if you're really poor and you're using dung for fuel in your hut, you're not concerned about what parts per million of CO2 are in the atmosphere. But when a country gets wealthy, we start worrying about things like the purity of the water in the air. And so I think that's the answer. Whatever ultimately you think about those questions, what we really should be doing if we care about people is helping the rest of the world get wealthy.
Yeah, so a couple of things. There has to be a balance here, though, right? Because we are called to be good stewards of God's creation. You're not negating that.
Not at all.
I mean, that's an imperative.
Absolutely.
We have to be good stewards. So, yeah, it's fantastic for us to be good stewards. But on the other hand, we can't give in to pseudoscience.
That's right. And this is I think this is honestly the reason that Christians get buffaloed by this, is that our compassion and our correct theology gets weaponized against us. So they say, look, you believe that we should be stewards of the world. God's, you know, told us to be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, to till the garden and keep it. And climate change is the worst environmental disaster in a generation. So Christians need to get on board. That's a kind of, there's some elision there logically. To be a good steward, right, is in other words, we do need to tend this. So I would say that's why we should find out what we're doing, right, and find out if it's actually harming things, let's fix it. I just think that the hysteria about climate change is overblown and based on bad arguments and bad inferences. And moreover, it tends to suck the air out of the room when it comes to real environmental concerns. There are legitimate environmental concerns with respect to toxins, and I worry about certain food additives and things that we have in the water that we're not paying attention to. We've been good at getting the big toxins out, but I think there's, look, we're doing something to the environment and our surroundings that it, to increase, massive increase in chronic diseases, especially among kids. Could be an environmental thing. We're not focusing on that. We're focusing on these kind of things having to do with climate change that I don't think are sort of well justified. So if you want to be a good steward and you want to care about the environment, the first thing you got to do is be discerning so that you can focus on things that actually help and not focus on things that actually hurt.
Yeah, discernment. You know, there's another thing that comes to mind, and you do write about this in your book as well, earthquakes. And I'm thinking about not only earthquakes, but hurricanes. I mean, we've just had two incredibly catastrophic hurricanes. And a lot of people will say, look, earthquakes, hurricanes are all signs that we're in a global warming catastrophe. The earthquakes are more frequent and more powerful. The hurricanes are more frequent, more powerful, et cetera. A lot of that is based on misinformation, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's so strange. And so people will, they'll take, for instance, a comparison. If you're to do sort of property damage in Florida in 2024 from a hurricane compared to property damage in 1700, well, there's almost no property damage in 1700, not because there are no hurricanes, but because nobody was building stuff there, right? And so you're not comparing apples and apples. So the relevant question is, okay, if warming is causing an increase in intensity of hurricanes, cyclones, tornadoes, let's look at the evidence. Anyone can do this. You can go online. There's absolutely no trend. There is no trend of increasing frequency, of increasing intensity of hurricanes or tornadoes. And in fact, weirdly, on some measures, there seems to be a kind of a declining trend. The problem is that every hurricane and every tornado is used as an example of climate change. And so that people come to interpret these events with that kind of framework, forgetting that, okay, there've always been hurricanes. So the only way to test that claim would be to look and see if there's like a trend line of increasing intensity and deadliness. And there just isn't one. So there's no reason to think that that's the case. Moreover, even on a kind of climate change theory is that the warming is going to happen primarily at the poles and not at the equator. And it's actually the difference between the temperature difference between the equatorial regions and the poles that give rise to hurricanes. So if anything, just on the theory itself, you'd expect hurricane intensity to decrease. But there's a kind of, there's just a rhetorical need for this. And so I always say, you know, when a cold thing happens, that's weather. When a hot thing happens, that's climate change. And, you know, they just count on everyone. If we have a year that happens to have low hurricane frequency, then nobody's going to talk about it. If we have a year like this in which we have a couple of really bad ones, it's going to be all climate change all the time, right? But what they're giving us an interpretive framework so that we will see these things as sign of the theory, when in fact that's not how you would do this. These are just individual data points.
I want to talk about some other very interesting thing. In chapter 4 of your book, it's titled Peering Up, and you talk about the transparent atmosphere. And you talk about it as one of the most eerie coincidences known to science. So you put a great deal of emphasis on this, and I want you to unpack that for a moment.
Absolutely. And so it's important to realize that just not any part of the electromagnetic spectrum would be useful for chemical life. And so like people would say, well, okay, if you know, you're around a planet in which you didn't get visible light on the surface, but maybe you got X-ray or microwave light, then life would just evolve to use that that part of the electromagnetic spectrum. No, that just misunderstands the kind of basic needs for life in this universe. It needs to be based on carbon. Carbon is the element that is what's called metastable. So it's stable enough that you can build three-dimensional complex molecules like proteins. You can code information in DNA, but not so stable that it doesn't undergo chemical reactions. So it's this kind of sweet spot. So you need, if you're going to have life in the universe, information-bearing life, it's going to be based on carbon, and then you're going to need a solvent for it where these reactions can take place. Well, that's water. So water and carbon are perfectly suited to each other. carbon chemistry is most reactive over this narrow range of temperatures over which water is liquid. And it's the same kind of thing in the electromagnetic spectrum. There are going to be certain types of energy, think of it that way, sort of energy from a star that life will find useful, and some that's not useful or is deadly. All right, so our atmosphere, which is another kind of feature of the same life, is going to need a nitrogen and oxygen-rich atmosphere. There's lots of choices. They're not all like that. That's, of course, what we have. Nitrogen-rich and oxygen-rich atmosphere is what's needed chemically for these life forms. It also happens to be transparent to the visible part of the electromagnetic spectrum, so that part of the spectrum that's needed for life gets through the atmosphere to the surface. But the atmosphere is not transparent to other parts of the spectrum. And because of the magnetic field we have around the Earth, a lot of the kind of deadly stuff that we might otherwise encounter is blocked.
We'll have to stop here for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with philosopher Jay Richards. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you the 20th anniversary revised and updated edition of The Privileged Planet, How Our Place in the Cosmos is Designed for Discovery. Just call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website at equip.org, that's equip.org, or you can write to CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters. Life matters more. Bertrand Russell famously said, "Most people would rather die than think, and many of them do." Not so with CRI support team members. Support team members are not only serious thinkers, but their membership in CRI's support team helps to equip hundreds of thousands of fellow believers around the globe each and every month. Are you not a member? Then you're missing out. Not only do support team members form the backbone of Christian Research Institute's outreaches, but they enjoy their selection of resources from our Equipping Essentials library. To discover how you can make a difference 24/7 in equipping believers at home and abroad to stand for life and truth, check out the benefits of membership at equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org.